Welcome to The Revenue Architects. I'm your host, Jeff Ignacio. In this podcast, we're going to bring incredible business athletes together. We'll explore how to build a go-to-market capability for businesses, no matter the size or shape. We'll remix content from a bunch of different places, bring in guests, deep dive into incredible topics. So with that in mind, I want to thank you for joining us. And now on to this episode of The Revenue Architects. Today, we have Andrew Hahn, a 20-year SaaS veteran who has led teams at Cornerstone On Demand, which at the time was the largest LA-based IPO. Now, being out of LA, that makes me tremendously proud. He's also worked at IBM Watson, FuelCycle, and all in senior leadership roles. Today, he's the chief revenue officer at FormAssembly, trusted by huge logos such as Target, Amazon, and my all-time favorite, the University of Michigan, where, of course, I went to get my graduate degree, so shameless plug. I first met Andrew through the LA Revenue Collective chapter, which we're both a part of. And so with that, I want to welcome Andrew to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity to collaborate.
Yeah, absolutely. So for all of our listeners who may not know who you are, can we get a quick synopsis like about you, your background, and then let's dig into FormAssembly a little bit?
Yeah, first and foremost, something that's probably taboo. Born and raised in LA, and I'm a family guy. Got a wife who I met at Cornerstone On Demand, who is vice president of product. Two kids and a dog, everything but a white picket fence. So that's my background. Professionally, I think you hit it pretty well. 20 years in software. So out of college, I actually started my own company with AI, working with NLP and AOL. There's a lot of letters. But we built customer service, early artificial intelligence. Sold that company. Got into traditional SaaS. I guess the greatest note, you talked about Cornerstone On Demand, where I was roughly employee 150 and got to experience not just hyper growth, but just amazing culture and do it right culture that leads by example and not just by words. Assisted through the IPO, and I'm very proud to brag that I was at least 1% responsible for that IPO. Some brilliant people working alongside of me. Used that AI background working with Watson. And then I joined FormAssembly, and I think you were alluding to that as well. Kind of a unique opportunity as CRO. FormAssembly has been around for 15 years. What we do is we're a big data aggregator. So our main play is Salesforce, but any company that has large amounts of data and wants to streamline that, we help them. So we focus in nonprofit, higher ed, FedRAMP, FinServ, and probably a few more verticals I should be familiar with. But 80 days in, it's been an amazing ride. It really has.
And that's really incredible because I think about, some say, well, hyper growth, right? They want to talk about rocket ships or unicorns, or nowadays some are reaching out for decacorns. You know, a decade ago, the seemed like the only unicorn in town was Salesforce, right? And now there's a whole spring of them coming. It's almost logarithmic in some ways. I'd love to dig in a little bit. So hyper growth, some will say that revenue cures all wounds, but in some ways, it can be chaotic, and you incur strategic, technical, process debt. How does a company, retain its culture or a sense of itself? You know, what do you think is the ingredient and the key to that?
It's a great question. I think authenticity. I feel like I'm a Hallmark card in saying that, but I've been at too many companies that force employees to fill out surveys to be best of. Which is BS. It really is. The great thing about Cornerstone, I'll speak to that because I spent 6 years there, is the culture remained the same from employee 150 to probably employee 1500. There were value propositions of what we look for in our people, and I'm going to get it wrong, but it was cool, smart, dependable. But the most important was one to have a beer with. And I think that's really important, where the culture is embedded and it feels right rather than forced. And I've been at large companies that say, you need to be happy. I think there's a real dichotomy in that. And I've been fortunate to be a part of some great cultures and some non-great cultures. And I was probably a reason for both. So I guess there's a level of humility on things that I've done well and things I've done poorly as a leader.
I love the idea of looking at oneself in the mirror and assessing, where you've succeeded and areas where you can improve. So absolutely makes perfect sense. You mentioned some industries that are highly regulated and notoriously tough to break into. So FedRAMP, FinServe? You know, what are some of the battle scars or things that you've learned along the way in order to compete in those spaces?
Yeah, I mean, specifically with FormAssembly, I mean, there's nothing I like more than taking credit for what other people have done for the last year prior to me getting there. FedRAMP was a unique approach. We're not in a red ocean. We're in a reddish blue ocean where we're not sexy enough for companies like Salesforce to build out their own data pipeline solution. But we have some real competitors there. It's so funny, man. I was going on a tangent. I almost forgot the question. Would you mind restating that, sir, so I can blame you?
No, I was just thinking about, you know, a lot of SaaS companies.
Oh, the highly regulated. I'm sorry.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
I was taking credit. Look, nonprofit isn't highly regulated. FinServe is debatable. Higher ed, the real thing that we did is we just announced last week that we were the first FedRAMP certified company. And that's huge. Now, our go-to-market is not FedRAMP, but we have amazing partners that are in that space. And we bet on ourselves to be the only company in this space with FedRAMP certification. Will it work? We certainly hope so. Might it fail? Absolutely. But we're looking at our partners to meet their needs. And we're hoping this catches on like wildfire, because I know how difficult it is for the federal government to make investments and jump through hoops. And this is one hoop they don't have to jump through.
So let's talk about FormAssembly a little bit. Congratulations, by the way, on the new role. And
thank you.
You and I spoke, I think, while you were searching for a new role. Little did I know that FormAssembly would have a good get with you. So, you know, I'm just stalking you on LinkedIn a little bit, and it looks like a little bit over 100 employees and a little over half in some sort of go-to-market function, whether that's BD, sales, or marketing. And, you know, as CRO, you know, what do you think is important to establish as you go into any new situation?
Okay, so you're being a little coy here. So the real story for anyone listening is I actually applied to be the chief sales officer at your company and didn't get the gig, and that's okay. I'm actually really excited. The person that you hired, Kevin Gaither, is phenomenal. So first of all, I want to kudos to you guys. We're differently good, and I have so much respect for him. When you ask about what's important, I have a philosophy that your first 90 days are the most important, which sounds very obvious, but let me add a little color to that. There is a competence side of it. There's a confidence side of it. But more importantly, there's a likability. And what I mean by likability is it is so important for me. I have 50 people that report to me. I set up one-on-one times with each one of them. And I took notes in OneNote, and I know where they live, if they got kids, if they got dogs. We connected on a personal level. And then I sold them the vision of change. And that's really important, because when you think about change, everyone wants change. But the reality is people are risk averse and change averse. So I created a level of empathy, and then together I sold them on a journey of, hey, we're changing and I really need you to step up together. And I got the buy-in. So I think that's the first thing. Second thing, you know, likability is cool, but I also think competence comes into play. So I had a 30-60-90 going into this, which everyone should laugh at, because 30-60-90s are a joke. I mean, this is what I want to achieve. The reality is you're going to spend your time in different areas. But I think it's imperative that you align with your CEO on what are the core metrics, not metrics, I'm sorry, core goals. I think metrics is more of a second and third quarter into your tenure. What do you want to establish? And I was very clear. I had three goals. I think it's three. I'll sound really bad if I don't. First is I wanted all of our sales reps to get on the same page. So I suggested a book called Gap Selling. Is it the best? Absolutely not. Is it a great book? Absolutely. I love the philosophy of Keenan of selling a current state, digging into the pain points, and then talking about a future state and walking in collaboration with our prospect. So that helped us really have a same vernacular and language, which I think was imperative. Number two is I built out a playbook. And what I thought I was going to do in this playbook and what I actually did were two different things. I sat on a lot of calls and I did a lot of mock calls with our team, and I saw some real gaps. I think we have a lot of high potential, and I needed to refine that skill. So it was a really unique opportunity to see what else needs to be in that playbook. I mean, playbooks consistently say how we go to market, resources we have, but there was some blocking and tackling that needed to be identified. So part one was gap selling. which again could be challenger, could be predictable revenue. It doesn't matter. Step two is building out a playbook. And step three is we hired a company called Winning by Design that I worked with briefly that I just really believe in their philosophy. So we're going to upskill our existing young talent and arm them with these weapons to be extremely successful. And if we can't be successful after the book, the playbook, and training, then I failed them. And I don't think that's going to happen.
So there's a three-pronged approach here, right? You're giving them three legs to stand on. And
well, I guess four, because I wanted them to like me and believe in what I was doing. So three and a half, yeah.
All right, that makes a table then.
Yes.
We talked about the first 90 days.
Yes. Yeah.
We talked about the first 90 days. It's actually one of my favorite books to read as I'm making a transition, whether it's internal or external. And one of the key takeaways that I always had was, you know, work with the end in mind, really design your goals and your objectives, and then work backwards from there, hopefully reprioritize and negotiate success. So I really love the concept of coming in. Whether 30, 60, 90 is instrumental or a great instrument for you to use, I can see at least having a framework mix for a good roadmap.
Let me actually challenge you that there in a fun way, if you don't mind. So you're on it. Like, I can't argue with having an end in mind and working your way back. I kind of see the role as a CRO, though. Like, this is going to be a bad metaphor. I'm just going to go with it. Like, I look at my leaders. So I have three heads of department, heads of and VPs. So head of partner, VP of sales, and VP of marketing. Like, my job, I kind of see it like the top of the dam, which is like just turning all of these knobs to create more leads, challenge them on what they're doing, go to existing partners and see what we can do more of, A-B test and marketing. I just want to like push water down and have them kind of be the filter. But my job is to create momentum. So I do have an endpoint in mind, but I'm also gambling, man. Like, I'm legitimately gambling on 10 different methods. And if seven of them work, we're going to reach that end goal of mine. So you have a beautiful mind and a strategy and an endpoint and how to reverse engineer it. I kind of have an F it attitude. I'm going to give them 10 amazing things. And if seven of them stick, we're going to reach that.
So let's just say we're coming from two ends of the spectrum here, right? And
sure.
There is a CRO in some company and they realize they need this go-to-market operations group or revenue operations or whatever they want to call it. How do you personally see that function partnering with you? And two, how would you define success for that group?
Okay, I was listening and I am going to ask you to ask that question again because I'm not sure what direction you want me to go.
Well, we talked about, I like to think about things with the end in mind and reverse engineer it.
Yep.
While you like to go forward and experiment and see what works so that you can double down on them down the road. And so part of that is the CRO and their partner, the go-to-market operations or revenue operations team. You know, what does that look like for you? And what does success ultimately come down to?
Great question. So one of the pivots I did initially is we're very lucky. 98% of our leads are inbound. Which I think anyone listening to this wants to punch me in the face right now for complaining. Like, it's a great problem to have, but I promise you it's still a problem. So we had eight SDRs. Five of them were focused on inbound. Three of them were focused on outbound. The biggest problem we had on outbound was our TAM was too big. So I talked to you about being aligned with Salesforce. Our TAM really is anyone that uses Salesforce. It's a great problem, but it's also a horrible problem. It's like the metaphor I use is if you're selling rims, your target audience is anyone that drives a car. Well, no, it's not. It's anyone in their mid-20s who thinks this is going to make them look good and has expendable cash and for whatever reason. So like I look at our TAM the same way. So our outbound efforts were really poor because we had hundreds of thousands of people to reach out to. So I paired two of the three outbound SDRs with account managers. We're heavily weighted on new business and not as much on LTV. So I have these two outbound now focused on expansion. So they're individually paired with account managers. So if we have a client like University of Michigan, Fab Five, Jalen Rose, let's do this. Dude, I've got stories about Jalen and Jawan for another day. personal stories, but amazing stories. I think we can do more within our existing install base. So the account manager is going to come up with a strategy, and we're calling SSDR, strategic SDR, is going to work with them hand in hand with an ABM strategy. So throwing out a lot. Back to your question, sir, on RevOps, I don't know. What I know is marketing is putting out phenomenal materials. And if I'm empathetic and I put myself in the shoes of salespeople, because I've been there before, you look at the shared drive, you download 5 assets that you think are going to be valuable, and those are your go-to assets. And they're antiquated and they suck. So my value in RevOps, and thank you, for those that don't know, you've been gracious enough to speak to my new RevOps employee, which I use one of those headcounts for, is to really increase the communication between departments, but also to look at our tech stack. I'm embarrassed and proud to say that we probably have 20 different vendors that we use, everything from lead generation to call recording to optimization to whatever buzzword you want to use. And I believe that we can have a greater impact on using 60% of our existing tech stack, but using it better. So I'm not trying to save money. It's actually the opposite. I'm trying to spend more with our existing vendors to get more, because I don't think there's a value in having 4 licenses for Gong if you're really trying to understand overall sentiment analysis. Long answer to a simple question, right?
There's a lot to unpack there. Like, first of all, 98% of the leads are inbound, but yet you're creating a strategy.
Oh, that was a half hour ago, bro. Yeah, but yes.
To create a strategy to get to, you know, take a foothold into an account and penetrate larger with a focus on LTV. Normally, I would think inbound would be very transactional, very high velocity, to the point you couldn't spend enough time on your calls and your research. But yet, here we are looking at, okay, let's take a look at this account, get into it with a seam, and then blow it up from there with an account management expansion play.
Well, think about inbound. So inbound doesn't mean they call you and say, hey, I want to buy it. Inbound could be anything. We still have the time on the majority of them to do some quick research and call and ask intelligent questions. But to your point, it's a great problem to have.
And then with outbound, you know, you're not targeting, you're not necessarily being, you know, you're not targeting your marketing, you're not creating a perspective around who you're going after. You even gave the example of Rams, but that's really interesting. You know, one of the things that I dig into is sometimes the material that marketing produces, like ICPs, personas, battle cards, things around competitive intelligence, oftentimes I find they're often stale as soon as the sales team picks it up, grabs and goes with it. What do you think is one of the best areas of collaboration between, you know, those two groups, figuring out how do we tie product and what's happening externally with the market and then bringing it down to the sales floor so that they can have really meaningful conversations?
I'm with you. I'm going to ask you to restate. So we talked about collaboration between two parties. Are we talking about product and sales or marketing and sales?
Well, every company is going to have it somewhat differently, right? There are these materials that are, you know, personas, battle cards, industries, yeah, things that could be useful in the heat of the moment when you're prospecting or in that secondary meeting when you're meeting some more stakeholders. How do you take that shelfware and bring it to life in the middle of a sales cycle?
Love that question, man. You could answer it better than I do, but let me take a stab at it. So every company has hundreds of documents and they do a very bad job of not only updating them, but I think with those hundreds of documents, there should be 8 to 12 go-to documents that we should be using. So first of all, I told you I was very proud of the playbook that I built, 65 pages. It was a brain dump. Marketing made me look really good. But what's most important is it's not the 2021 playbook. It is a 2021 iterative playbook, because we have to be committed to refining the playbook, because for me to put my stamp on it and say, this is how we do business, is wrong. So not only is the playbook talk about how we go to market, the tools that we use, the language that we use, equally important is that we keep things updated. So within the playbook is not only links to our most important documents, but actually video recordings to how to use those documents. And I think that's important. So when we talk about collaboration, I think it goes back to revenue operations or sales operations, whatever you want to call. It is having someone being the owner of keeping things real, keeping things fresh, making sure that anything that is antiquated is in a folder called archive. and really making sure that people aren't downloading old stuff and using it again and again. So, you know, if I circle back to whatever I started to 15 minutes ago on this answer, it goes back to using the term playbook and calling it iterative and making sure that when we have changes, people go and have the newest stuff. And we have a physical printout of this, but it's also digital. And we've always been, we are over 100 employees. We were 100% virtual before the pandemic. We're 110% after the pandemic. But I am asking that they literally keep this tab open at all times, the playbook, and they have the physical copy at all times. This is our playbook, man. I mean, I love the term playbook. It is literally the book on how to run plays.
One thing I thought was interesting was, you know, having 20 tools, right? There's some, I guess, belief that when you go into, as a sales ops person, you go in and assess the stack, how much of it is actually used and looking at how much has been logged in. You talked about doubling down on the tools that made a lot of sense. I would love to hear some trends on things that you've seen change over the last 5 years that have somewhat made a meaningful impact, because Serious Decision talks about how tech spend is increasing year over year, but yet the percentage of reps hitting quota is decreasing year over year. And it's not necessarily that causation and correlation there, but I just think it's an interesting pattern.
Got it. So I heard two questions. By the way, man, this is on me. This is a Friday afternoon. So one is tech stack overview and what my philosophy there is. And what was part two?
Part two is, do you necessarily believe that just adding technology for the sake of having something?
No. I don't have the budget for that, man. So when I look at tech stack overview, like, look at your technology and what is it for? Look, let's take something very simple that we don't have, DocuSign. Everyone understands it. If every single sales rep is sending out an agreement, or legal staff sending out agreement via DocuSign, it's 100% adoption. What is the value of 33% of your reps using DocuSign, 33% of them using HelloSign, 33% of them faxing over agreements? Like, there's hopefully no one's faxing over agreements. It's pretty pointless. So where it makes sense, I want full utilization. I want our SDRs all to be using the same tools on discovery and research. I want all of our salespeople, whether they're account executives or account managers, to be using the same tools for not just research, but for proposal delivery. One thing that we are improving on, so, you know, I'm talking to the public about areas of improvement, is we have Gong. And I think Gong is the greatest metaphor, because one is I can listen to calls, but equally important is the overall sentiment analysis and understanding competitive words that are getting thrown out or challenges or whatever it is. But if we have six people using Gong, I don't think that's a good enough indicator on how we pivot our business. It's too small of a sample size. The Harris poll exists for a reason. Political polls exist for a reason, but there's a reason there's a plus or minus 10% on any of those. I am not going to change I'm not going to change my business based upon three or four or five or six reps that may have gaps or strengths that are not consistent with the rest of the sales team. Oh, and then adding technology. Yeah. Sure. If there's value, I think I'm empathetic being a sales leader, that, like, I think I'm nicer to any cold call or cold email than anyone should be. I believe in the big four, the big four philosophy. No one gets fired for hiring the big four. Right now, we're currently assessing Vidyard versus BombBomb. They're both good tools. Our technical issue is more about our computers and our technology than it is about the tool. Like, either tool will be fine, but I believe in the young upcoming companies, but I think I need to really know that the tool that I go and we go all in with is going to provide high value, and it's trusted by industry leaders. And that might sound old school, but I can't make a 10K or 20K risk on a up and coming tool unless their value to our unique niche surpasses anyone else.
So we have this segment called the Rorschach test, and I'm just going to say a few words or something to that effect. And I'd like to hear the kind of the first thing that comes to your mind.
Go on. Let's do this.
So the first one, personalization versus relevance.
Wow. Anyone listening by now knows I am not short on opinion. Wow. Personalization. And I'll tell you why. I believe in connecting with people and empathy. Don't get me wrong, relevance is huge. But I think the ability to get people out of their comfort zone and more into their personality, I'm making up these stats, but like on Zoom videos, like 55% that wins deals is body language, 30% is tone, and 15% is what is actually said. So boom, man, there's your answer.
Now B2B versus B2C.
Ready for another mic drop?
Let's do it.
B2B2C. B2B2C. How do you feel about that? And let me tell you why. Gosh, I'm passionate about this. We have to be, so Form Assembly is a great example. Our buyers are companies that want, I mean, our business sounds really boring in simplicity, but it's not. They're buyers, they're people that want a better way to have an online form. Boring as hell, sure. What is cool about it, and I focus them on, is don't just worry about your admin experience, and we're second to none. Worry about the end user experience, the people filling out forms. So we work with a large city who will remain nameless. Let's just call it LA, and it's not, but I want you to think big city. And you're like, what would they use forms for? So everything from the police department to booking someone, Caucasian male, 45, assault and battery, to I have COVID. Really, you have COVID. What are your symptoms? Listing your symptoms. Like I said, B2B2C to not only piss you off and to have fun, but I think it's a B2B market, but we have to be so empathetic and passionate and aware of the end user, not just the two people wearing suits closing deals.
Oh, it's hard to rattle me, so don't worry about trying to piss me off here.
Oh, it was a welcome piss off. It's all good.
You talk about channel sales, you're bringing in partners. So channel sales is my next topic.
Yeah, channel's imperative for us. We brought up FedRAMP. I don't believe, and I could be wrong because I'm wrong on probably half of the assumptions I've made here. I don't believe you can have an effective go-to-market in the Fed space without a designated team. You're going to overpay someone that worked at DocuSign or Salesforce or Cornerstone, pay them a base of 180 or 200 to penetrate that market. A ton of our leads, we talked about our qualified leads, come in because they're so highly qualified because of our partners. And we love our partner community. We don't kick back to our partners. We don't pay them on deals. What's important, and I highlight that for a reason. We talked about B2B2C. I believe in the win-win-win. So when we can make money, our partner can make money, great. But more importantly, when their client can see value in our tool is what's absolutely imperative. So we have about a dozen partners. And as you can imagine, it's a 70-30 rule where 30% of our partners are bringing in 70% of the revenue. But that's cool. So when I look at our FedRAMP strategy, I'm not hiring a federal team. But what I am doing is making sure that all of our partners know we're FedRAMP certified. And considering we have, 30 salespeople and 5 people on our, we call it a partner, you can call it channel, you can call it alliance, is really our understanding of the value that we bring to our partners to help them sell their services and products. But more importantly, the impact of the end user and the consumer.
Product-led growth.
Product-led growth. Oh my gosh, thank you for bringing this up. Now I got to open up a tab because I have so many tabs open. Product-led growth is literally a book that I started reading yesterday. What's that?
Is it Wes Bush's book?
It is. So I don't know if I mentioned this earlier. My wife, I think I did. I met her at Cornerstone On Demand. She's vice president of product. There you go. You have it in front of you. It's been a really neat thing in quarantine. We're working 20 feet from each other. She's become more sales aware and focused, and I become more product focused. So really think of Form Assembly as kind of DocuSign. I've brought them up for 5 times. I think I'm going to have to pay them commission at some point. We have a self-service model, and then we have a sales service model. And I think that's really important, the dichotomy. So one of the initiatives that I'm taking over in Q2 is higher conversion and higher ACV on our 2 packages, which are self-service. So product-led growth, I'm in a unique, horrible, wonderful problem where I'm trying to build our ACV on go-to-market enterprise, but still trying to grow the conversion and ACV on trials and figuring out if freemium, free trial, I'm trying to figure out what the right go-to-market, but the timing couldn't have been funnier as I'm 33 pages into that book.
That's so funny. Last two, MQL, real or not?
Oh gosh, am I allowed to cuss on this podcast?
You are.
Great. MQL is bullshit. So, God, I could use a lot worse words. I think it is a horrible conflict of interest. It is a measurement that marketing has to be measured on, but it is an incestual, disgusting metric where if you set up your leads in marketing to be measured by MQLs, it's in their best interest to bring in MQLs. What I care more about is conversion from MQL to SQL. So that talks about two things. It talks about quality of that lead, but also talks about quality of our SDRs and our AEs to actually convert them. So look, when I said I hate it, I love it, man. Like, give me, right now we're trending at about 600 MQLs a month. Great problem to have. Could we do more with 500? Sure. Could we do more with 800? Sure. It's just, I mean, you're measuring me on taking swings in batting practice. Like, I think they're important. And I've actually, I just revisited my VP of marketing's comp and I've lowered the measurement on MQLs for that reason. Because look, she can 2X her MQL number if they're bullshit leads, which she would not do because she's ethical and wonderful.
And the last one, deal velocity.
I'm going to embarrass myself and say, what do you mean by deal velocity? You mean as far as sales cycle or?
So deal velocity is classically defined as the rate of change of how much revenue is contributed from the existing pipeline. And it looks at a couple of metrics, size of pipeline, propensity to win, average deal size, and the average time to close. And it gives you this rate change of speed, so to speak.
So I'm going to leave you with the best answer ever. My answer is yes. Deal velocity is imperative. I mean, come on, man. These are all levers. So one thing we're doing right now is looking at our Salesforce stages, and I'm updating them right now because I think the most important thing is our ACV is roughly 12K. Our sales cycle is 55 days, which is too long. It should be closer to 30. I ain't mad at anyone. Let me be very clear. But what we're doing in refining our Salesforce stages is having greater insight and granularity into where we're getting stalled. And I can tell you one thing we've immediately known is it's a technical review. So that tells me that we need to lean on our tech team to have, they're great, but we just need to leverage them better and have best practices that could speed things up. So deal velocity, sure, let's speed things up in our sales cycle. So my short answer is yes.
Andrew, this has been great. Just want to thank you for coming on. And lastly, where can our listeners find out more about you or how can they connect with you?
Great question. Let me turn on my radio voice. So I am on LinkedIn, Andrew Hahn, H-A-H-N, CRO at FormAssembly. You could follow me on Instagram. I probably won't accept you. I would just say that. Feel free to reach out to me. Do something high value. Just don't connect with me. Give it a sales tip. I mean, don't say we share common connections. It would be great if we connect. Just put something of real value, man. And let's not just be connections. Let's actually be value-based partners in both of our go-forward strategy.
Amazing. Thanks again, Andrew.